Hi, this is Cheryl. Is there anybody else on?
Hi, Cheryl. Randall.
Hey,
Kathleen.
And who?
Rick Wasner.
Hey, Rick. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good. Do you have lots of snow on the ground?
Well, it's snowing, but didn't get a whole lot. It's wet snow and then rain and then wet snow again, so it's kind of yucky out there.
And Kathleen, what does your situation look like?
Well, we're supposed to get maybe just a teeny little bit of snow tonight, but then it's supposed to turn to ice.
Oh.
So that doesn't sound like much fun tomorrow. How about you guys?
Cheryl, and I'm here. It's Allison Bailey.
Hey, Allison, welcome.
And it's sleeting at my house, joy of joys.
Ugh.
Yeah,
I can live without
winter. The snow is starting to go away, so anyway, it's all right.
Yeah.
Cheryl, how is it down the Carolinas?
Well, Allison is in what I would call the Piedmont section of Carolina. I'm closer to the mountains, and where I am, I don't think we've gotten anything other than last week ago, and we've still got that all over the place. Who just joined?
It's snowing in Maryland.
Oh, well. And who's from Maryland?
Nobody. I'm in Charlotte.
You joined. Okay. Who else joined?
Well, I was just talking to somebody driving in Maryland.
Who joined?
This is Sudie.
And who joined?
Hi, Cheryl Sand.
Welcome.
Who else do we have, anybody?
We've got a bunch.
Oh, good. Very good.
I think we've got Sudie and yourself and Stag and Allison, Rick Wasner.
Oh, great. That's good.
I think John Marsh is supposed to be joining. Kathleen's already on.
Yeah. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello.
Hello. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
And I know that, Kathleen, thank you very much for sending that article. It was, let's just say, one of those, okay, and now what do we do? So can we turn it over to you and you kind of read us through things a bit and maybe we can get the questions addressed along the way, okay?
Okay, did you want to go through the article? Is that how you'd like to?
I think that would be sort of useful if that would work for you, and then we can also, we ought to make sure we have some amount of time at the end to get to the questions if we haven't already addressed them, okay?
Okay.
And everybody, you know, sort of like the ground rules are, you can ask questions whenever, okay?
Okay. Well, the reason for writing the article was that on the horse feed market, there's an awful lot of new high-fiber, low-starch feeds. And I was frequently asked, like, well, is this the right feed for my horse, or what are the benefits of high-fiber feeds? And so that's where this all came from. And the article came out in Trailblazer magazine. But and in the beginning of the thing, I gave a little bit of an evolution of why people started thinking about high-fiber feeds, because if you think about the horse's diet and from way back when, it's always been sort of a high-fiber diet. So what's new about these high-fiber feeds? And I don't know if you really want to go into, you know, how that all came about. But the result is we do have these on the market, and what are their advantages? So in order to understand...
Before you get too far down, could you sort of go into... to just as a background check, at least in my own head. Okay, horse diet in the wild is pretty much lots of fiber because they're eating grass all the time. We're pretty dried up, whatever it is they do eat.
Yeah.
Then, so we've got them domesticated and we're feeding them other things, but we're still feeding them grass and hay.
Right.
And then we go to high fiber. And in a concentrate, how does a high concentrate deal with high fiber versus the type of fiber they get in what I would call forage?
Yeah, in forages. Okay, well, fiber itself is a pretty general term, and it just is. It's a type. Actually, it's a type. The type of carbohydrates that you find. If you think about a cell, you have like a cell wall, and then you have the inside of the cell, and the inside of the cell are usually your non-structural carbohydrates or your starches or your sugars or something that's very easily digested. And then the cell wall itself is going to be made up of another type of carbohydrate that they add structure to the cells. So those are your structural carbohydrates, and those are in the human beings not digested. But the horse has billions of bacteria and fungi and protozoa in their digestive tract that actually can break down that cell wall and produce energy for the horse. But within the cell wall itself and the different fibers found in the cell wall, different types of fibers, some are digestible and some are not digestible or indigestible. And so what the bacteria are attacking and breaking down for the horse are those digestible fibers. So if you looked at natural forages, if you looked at grass, it has digestible fiber and indigestible fiber. And of that, the digestibility of that grass, it depends on how mature the grass is, but it's somewhere between 30 and 50% digestible. So it's not like 100% digestible fiber and by any means. So you can see that when a horse eats grass, you can see that what comes out the other end has still some fiber to it, and that would be mostly your indigestible fiber. And in the feed industry, when they start making fiber, high fiber feeds, they're usually using some sort of byproduct of the feed industry that is something lots left over that happens to be useful for animals. So if you looked at beet pulp, for example, beet pulp is what's left after you've made sugar beet, or you've extracted the sugar out of the sugar beet, and then you have all the fiber that's left, and of that fiber, there's a lot of digestible fiber. So about almost 80% of that is digestible. It's able to be broken down by those microbes. And so that makes beet pulp a really good fiber source for the horse. Another product used in commercial concentrates to increase fiber is soy hulls, which is the skin of the soybean. And like if you think about a pea, usually there's like a skin on the outside of the pea, and then the inside is the starchy part, but the outside is taken off the soybeans and when they go to process the soybeans, particularly for oil, and then that fiber that's on the outside is used in the animal feed industry, and it's also really high in digestible fiber, so about 75% digestible fiber. So if you think about that beet pulp and soy hulls with their fiber digestible fiber being 75 to 80%, that's higher than the hays that we would be feeding horses. If you looked at young spring grass, it would be closer to, and really soft, immature grass, the digestible fiber in that is closer to what you find in beet pulp and soy hulls. But just the normal hay that we would feed or a much more mature grass, the fiber is much lower. So the more digestible fiber you have, the more calories you're actually able to provide for the horse, because those microbes are breaking down that fiber and producing the volatile fatty acids, which the horse can use for calories. Does that explain what you were trying to?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to get us off a bit on a digression, but it was one of those.
Yeah. So a horse's diet, I mean, your average backyard horse already has a really high fiber diet, because many of them are getting the majority of their diet of their calories from their hay and grass that they're getting, and then maybe getting a little bit of grain. So this notion of them having to be on a high fiber feed doesn't necessarily benefit them as much as you might a horse that has a diet that is 50% hay and 50% of a concentrate. You could see that maybe a high fiber, high fat feed would be helpful in increasing the amount of fiber in the horse's diet when there's that much concentrate being fed. But this, you know, like the horse that is only getting maybe half a scoop a day or a scoop a day of feed, it's still, and then the rest is hay. That's a pretty high fiber diet. So how that works for the endurance horse, when those fibers are in that hindgut and then they're being broken down by the microbes, it's a constant process. So that these horses are always getting a little bit of energy from that fiber in that gut. So even if they're running down the trail, they're still getting some calories, some energy from the breaking down of this fiber. So it is a really important fuel source for the endurance horse. And I think that's something we need to just not to forget.
Let me play. It's been a long time since I've read the article, so please be a little bit charitable here. As the endurance horse is going down the trail, and you've got fibers in the hindgut, the point of having the concentrate be a high fiber concentrate is that presumably proportionately they're getting more fiber that they can break down into energy sources on a weight-for-weight basis or whatever you want to call it. If they've got that in their hindgut, is that the concept?
Yeah, that's the concept. And so it's another way to get fiber in there. And also having a variety of fibers in the hindgut is good, because then you get there's so many different types of little microbes that are in there that are actually digesting. It's nice to not the hindgut dependent on like one particular type of microbe. So when you have different types of fibers, so you have hay and you have bee pulp and you have soils and you have a couple of different kinds of hay, maybe grass and hay, and it does help the health of that body of microbes and the abundance of the microbes, gives them more substrate to work on and more content. So if you can get, I'm not saying that the diet of the endurance horse needs to be 100% fiber, because there are advantages to the horse having some starch in the diet, and we'll get into that, I guess, in a minute. But fiber is really very important. And if you have a horse that gets to a competition and is not eating, particularly not eating hay, or not eating hay well, and there's a way to sneak fiber into that horse with some of these high fiber feeds, that may be, you know, what it takes to get that horse to have at least enough fiber in the gut to have, to be able to keep gut sounds and get down the trail with the energy that it needs.
One of the things that I've always heard about having hay and grass is that horses who eat the hay and the grass will typically drink more.
Uh-huh. Yes. KER did a study looking at the grass versus hay on that drinking, and they did find that dry hay will trigger a thirst response. And
now, how would that be, on the theory that water is good?
Yeah. here's my take on that study. Yeah, that hay will trigger the thirst response, and grass didn't trigger it. But, and that's not to say that the horses didn't drink when they were given grass. They drank more with hay. But hay is only 10% water at the most. Grass, you're looking at maybe somewhere 70, you know, maybe sometimes 80% water.
Right.
You've already snuck in a lot of water in that horse when the horse gets grass.
Right. But where I was going with that is, how do you get does the high fiber concentrate trigger the same thirst response so that you get the water pulled into the hindgut and all that?
Yeah, theoretically it should. A lot of the high fiber concentrates that's a problem with the system of marking tags and stuff like that, are not as high fiber as you may think. But theoretically, yeah, that should also happen. But I don't know if I've seen a study on that to see if that would. Now, if you're feeding fibers on the side, like bee pulp, usually it's going to be soaked. And so there, again, you've already got water into it.
Right. But a lot of the high fiber feeds,
you don't need.
They come and you're feeding them as concentrates, and frankly, you just kind of give the horse that and say, "Okay, eat it." And the horse can maybe look at you and say, "That's good," or you can look at you and say, "Are you kidding me?"
Like a lot of these high fiber feeds, you can actually see the bee pulp in it because it'll be not like inside the pellet or something like that. It's actually, it looks like little bits of tobacco or something. But that those feeds you can offer them wet, but the horses usually prefer those if you put the water on at the last minute and not let them soak like you would regular just bee pulp.
Yeah.
But your question as to whether they trigger the thirst response.
Yeah, it basically will the thirst response, and then at drawing the water into the whole digestive system, which I think is, as I say, water is good.
Yeah, water. Any way you can sneak water into them is good, or get them drink or.
Yeah, and I like them to ideally get into the habit of just drinking and whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And Stag or Rick or somebody was.
Oh, I was saying, how quickly, if you fed them these feeds at a stop versus more traditional grain at a stop, is there a difference between how quickly that energy is accessible to them?
Okay. There is a difference because when you feed grain, the starch in the grain is digested in the small intestine, and that the food would be in the stomach maybe about 15-20 minutes, and then it hits the small intestine, and then So from 20 minutes to 2 hours, this is just generally, what you're seeing is the starches and the sugars being digested, and then they're going into the bloodstream in the form of glucose. So the tradition, so it's good to offer, like at a stop, some type of grain, because that is going to be a quicker energy source. And then your fibers, they aren't hitting that hindgut, for a while, because they have to pass all the way through the small intestine. There are a small amount of the fiber digesting bacteria found in the stomach, and a very small amount also in the small intestine. So you'd have a teeny little bit maybe happening along the way, but the majority again wouldn't be producing any energy till it hits the cecum and the colon of the hindgut. But you have the whatever you fed before the horse started racing that's in there, that should still be in there, passing through that hindgut and getting fermented and producing energy. So at the stop, maybe that's not what they're getting. You know, they're getting at that time, but down the road it will help. So if you kept something going in all the way through, every time they come into a stop, and then you're just you just keep adding on to it. In other words, it, does that make any sense?
Yeah, you know, that's what I was trying to think through is how do you make sure that the horse isn't going to hit points where you know they're hitting lows, even though the input into the system, it's not yet accessible, but they used up whatever they had. Because I mean, one, ironically, if it seems to me, if I go do, well, I'll look at the weight at the World Championship, right? A horse like the leaders, Nobby, you know, they were doing what was Nobby's time? It's under 8 hours, like a little over 7.5 hours.
Yeah.
And there were, what, 5 holes, Cheryl? It's like 5 holes.
That sounds right.
Yeah, so he was never going that long without them stopping for food, right?
Right.
Now, the Old Dominion has the same number of holes, typically. But you know, you may go 3 hours between holds, even if you're running a pretty fast pace at the Old Dominion, and even longer if you're running a moderate pace, right?
Right, because you're just longer, right.
So ironically, you have at a slower pace ride, unless you're stopping to feed on trail, you have a higher probability of, it seems to me, of hitting periods where the horse is, you know, out of energy source. Unless
yeah.
you're very carefully feeding.
Yeah. That's certainly true for the, yeah, the sources that would be producing glucose, like your starches and your sugars. That's certainly, definitely true. But they can, the forage in the hindgut stays for a long time. I mean, you're looking at maybe 13 hours to go from start to the end at the shortest. So, well, I guess they do increase gut motility when they're running because you can see that because they get runny stools. But you should be able, if you're able to feed them well and they eat well at each stop, they should be able to have something in there that's fueling them. The fuel,
but,
yeah, go ahead.
But it sounds like from what you're saying in terms of the fiber as an energy source, the day before is really more critical.
If you think about it, that if they can go into the ride with a full hind gut, they're better off. Yes, because if it's in there 13 hours, that may, you know, that may be the ride itself. They may be, you know, finished by that time.
Mm-hmm. If they start the ride with the best source in the hind gut, they've got the best chance.
Okay, and so fiber is not, again, is not, fiber is important. Carbohydrate, the non-structural carbohydrate, the starch you get from grains and sugars you can get from molasses, are your quicker energy sources. But they also, the day before, if we're talking about fueling up the horse, they, the day before that, before the competition, those are the sources that are going to build up the muscle glycogen stores. So it's also important to have a little, some sort of starch and sugar in the diet for the horses, even before the race and then during the race that can be used for quicker energy, the blood glucose, keeping blood glucose levels good fueling amount.
How much of that actually stores?
Of the starch?
Yeah.
Well, what the horse doesn't use right away for energy would go into storing and topping up glycogen levels, when they get to kind of like where the muscle, there's a point where the muscle's not going to, you just, it doesn't keep building more and more and more and more. It has sort of a level where it stops. And then after that, if you have excess glucose or starch in the diet, then it'll go to form fat. It's stored away as adipose tissue.
Okay. And
so you can't, with horses, they have not been successful at glycogen loading muscle cells like you can with humans, where
mm-hmm.
Gave them a real high protein diet and then boom, bang, a bunch of starch, and that's how you get a horse to tie up. But it works in humans. It does not work with horses. But horses already have much higher levels of glycogen in their muscle cells than humans do anyway. Trying to shove it and increase the amount of glycogen they're going to have in the muscle cell just doesn't work with them.
Kathleen, this is John Marsh. I joined late. Sorry.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
Okay. How are you?
Good.
I was just listening to all this, and I'm this is going to be a terribly difficult question probably to answer, but I'll ask it anyhow.
Okay.
It seems that the horse during the competition events getting energy from a variety of sources, the quick source, which is the starches and the glucose, I guess, and then the high fibers in the hindgut, and then we just talked about glucose in the muscle, and then you have fat reserves.
Right.
Kind of, is there a sequence of these are drawn down, and is it kind of very linear, or are they drawing from all these sources at different proportions kind of all the time?
They're drawing from there is a sequence of events, and it's usually the best way to see the sequences is right at the start of an bout of exercise, and that's been studied more in horses than long-term exercise. But you could see if you have intense exercise, really fast, a really fast gallop, the first thing that goes is the innate energy that's in the cell, and that's gone within seconds. So then it draws on glucose and glycogen, and starts breaking that down. In endurance type exercise, you'd see that maybe right when they first start out, that might be it, but very quickly the body switches over to being able to burn fat for energy,
right?
And so then it starts pulling on fat stores. But it's also drawing, if you looked at muscle glycogen at the end of an endurance exercise, you'd see that there's some glycogen is gone, some or all of the muscle glycogen is gone. So the horse is drawing from the glycogen in the muscle cells. It's also drawing from fat in the fat cells, and then it's using this stuff that's circulating in the bloodstream, like the volatile fatty acids from the fiber digestion. So it's a whole combination of energy sources. Just
the reason, part of where I was going with this was, again, my understanding was is the horse starts to exercise and starts to sweat, blood flow kind of moves away from the gut. And they start to cool. It's pushed. The blood flow is pushed out. And so I was thinking that you wouldn't be getting a lot of the energy from the guts during the event, but of course when they slow down, then that's when you might start to get the rebuild.
Yeah.
Does that make some sense, or is that?
And particularly in humans, it's a lot more distinct. But the work that they've done with blood circulation in exercising horses, they don't see as much of the blood flow going away from the organs as you do in humans.
Okay.
So a little bit less. Then also the speed that the horses are going, since they aren't going flat out,
right.
The energy system is aerobic and is a fat-burning system and can and then, like I say, and then better blood flow to the mesentery and the organs keeps the steady flow of energy coming in.
Okay, very good.
Now, Kathleen, the fat that they're burning in this case is fat that they've stored. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And I was told, I don't know whether this is valid or not, and they're like, we will supplement our horses. Maybe this isn't a practice one should even do, given the current knowledge, but you know, something we've done for many years, is add a little, we use canola oil, but some sort of oil to the horse's feed rather than just increasing their grain. Now, we feed a high-fat grain, but then, you know,
add more.
Four to 6 weeks before a ride, we'll start adding quarter cup or so of canola oil morning and evening. But then we were told that you ought to take it off about a day or two before the ride because it becomes counterproductive. And so, I mean, is that still valid thinking, or is that the current research would say that's not proper?
Yeah, I wish we knew more about this, and I think it really does need to be studied a little heavier. I know that the fat in the diet, you would hope that it could be used for calories for the horse, and it can be broken down. Again, it's a little while they're exercising, it can be broken down. Doesn't necessarily have to come from adipose tissue. There is fat in the diet that can be broken down and used. It's a little slower mechanism than like the utilization of glucose. But what's confusing a little bit to me is if that fat in the diet during exercise is counterproductive, if it's too much fat. And one of the things that KER actually looked at was what fat does in the stomach. Is it and then how slowly is it digested? And what we did see was it looks like that fat it moves slower through the stomach and then through the digestive tract. So it's slowing the rate of passage of feed. Now, one way I think that that probably is not good up for exercise. Another way is I think, maybe that is good, because part of the problem with ulcer development is the horse is having an empty stomach. So and then the stomach's still producing acid, and so if anything that could slow something going through the stomach, that would be good. So we don't have enough research to really know which is the best. But if you see that your horse is and when humans try to run with a lot of fat in their diet, you know, they cramp up. Sometimes Stag, you're a runner, right? If you hadn't...
Probably ex-runner is a better description.
You kind of get intestinal cramping, and we might think that might be true for horses too, but we don't really know because, you know, they can't say, I ate too much fried chicken and now I'm really paying for it. it is a subject that we really don't understand thoroughly and in the horse, and there needs to be more work on that part of it.
So that would tend to indicate that maybe if you're doing the fat supplements, you probably want to pull the horse off those couple of days ahead of time.
Well, what I would say is, like, if you're feeding a high-fat feed and the horse is fine eating it it doesn't go off the feed during a race, you're probably okay. But if you're doing high fat and more oil, then maybe, yes, a day or so. Or just so that when the horse, like that day before, so that the digestive that's going through the digestive tract during the race is not really, you know, loaded with fat. So maybe that day before you could take the oil out. But if it's a high, like the high fat feeds are about 10%, is pretty much the highest. You know, like there is a feed that's up that's 12% fat, and rice bran itself is 20% fat. But if you're feeding a high fat feed, I think, and that's what your horse's body is adjusted to and accustomed to, and it digests it well, and they will keep eating it during the ride. I think that you don't need to change feet for that reason.
I was thinking the additional, you know, liquid fat that you pour on top of the high fat feed.
That would be, that would probably where you could stop. And then the horses that are doing the ones over in Dubai are doing the 5 hour and 50 minute hundreds. Those horses probably would not tolerate a lot of fat in their diet the day of that race at all. But our races, are 10 and 12 and 15 hour hundreds. They certainly, like I say, if they have a normal diet with a high fat feed, they should be fine during a race with a high fat feed.
At the same time, my horse will back away from his grain out of ride in favor of hay.
Well, that's good. Maybe he knows best.
I'm kind of, what's he trying to tell me?
And does he like alfalfa hay better during a ride than grass hay, or does it matter?
He tends to like the alfalfa better, but it's not to the exclusion of grass.
Yeah. That's good.
And he's still educating me a lot.
I think on the day of the race, if it's whatever they want to eat, as long as you're getting something in them, I think that's what's important.
Yeah. He's the first horse I've ever had who couldn't care less about grain.
That's amazing. There's not many of those around.
Somebody else started to ask a question there, I think.
Yeah, I was this is John again. I think Kathleen, from a prior conversation, might have been in Jeannie Waldron's kitchen. we were talking, you made the comment, and I'm not even sure you were talking with me, but it was about fat supplementation of the diet. And where I am, where our horses are, they're at a boarding facility where, we really don't have much choice to change the grain. We get what we get. But you can supplement it. So we have the opportunity to use a fat supplement, and we use Cool Calories 100, and that's generally through the winter. But your comment was, if you want to supplement a horse, and I'm just paraphrasing what I heard, so I want you to correct me, that's why I'm doing this, is to help them in a ride with, additional fat stores, you have to start at least a month in advance, maybe 2 months in advance. You just can't start a few weeks in advance and hope to have any progress on that. So is that
right? Well, what
am I hearing that correctly?
Yeah, Well, that's for the horse to be able to turn on that mechanism that triggers the utilization of fat during exercise.
Uh-huh.
It is what they found, that when you feed a high fat diet, that the horse's ability to turn on that mechanism improves and becomes much more efficient when a horse is on a high fat diet, which takes that mechanism, that adaptation to being able to turn on that mechanism, takes a little time. And that's why you would need to have the horse on. You can't just dump a cup of corn oil the day before the ride and hope it'll help the horse.
Because I've heard folks say, well, we just, go back and for a few weeks we'll give the horse some supplement and they'll be ready to go. And I'm thinking,
it works quite that fast. It's about 5 weeks.
Okay.
The studies at KR have seen.
Okay, very good. That's what I thought I heard. I just wanted to make sure.
Yep.
It sounds like of all the things we're talking about in terms of doing for the horse, that has the longest lead time.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Well, their diet's already going to have fiber in it, so that's not something you're not introducing new to them.
Right.
And grain, like if your horse doesn't normally get grain, and there are a few that do compete that way, but they are going to get it at the rest stop, I always recommend that they have a little of something in that diet, at least the week before, if not 2 weeks, starting just so you give the digestive system a little bit of time to get used to having that substrate in there for it to break down. So,
how important is it on the grain that it, they have the same type of grain? In other words, we normally feed, because we can't get KERs down here, we've been feeding, you know, the Blue Seal, Fendid Victory, I think it is, right, Jill?
Yes.
But then it rides, you know, they always like, well, the best food is the neighbor's food, of course.
Of course.
But we've also, like, recently found that we offer them just some oats and, you know, things they don't normally get. They eat better at
right.
the whole.
Yeah.
Should we be giving them some of that leading up to the ride because it is a different grain from what they normally get?
If it's something, yes, that's a good day. I mean, even if it's just a handful, just throwing it in there, you know, you don't have to totally switch them to the ride they're going to get, the meal that they, type of meals they're going to get on the day of the ride, because then might defeat the purpose of offering them something a little different. But if they don't normally get oats in their feed, then just throwing maybe a cup of oats or a half a cup of oats into their feed the week before, or starting, you know, just maybe even let, you know, a little, just a teeny little bit, maybe a sprinkle on the Sunday before, if you're going to compete the following Saturday, so the Sunday before, and then increase it a little bit if you want, just so that
okay.
it does give them a little bit of what they're going to be having the day of the ride. It's not such a shock to the system. But as you know, the neighbor's feed is always the best feed when you're at the ride anyway, so you can't really avoid avoid it 100% all the time, you know, getting them some, having some sort of shock to their system. But something like bee pulp also, if they're not used to getting bee pulp on a daily basis, but the day of the ride they're going to get a bran mash with bee pulp, just adding a little bit during the week before to their diet is really a good way to sort of just
okay.
take the shock out of it all.
Now, this gets into what's the shock to the system? The stuff that a lot of people, including us, feed tends to be what you might call a mixture of a lot of different stuff, premix of some sort or another. And yeah, you can see some oats in there, and you can see that looks like some beet pulp, and then there's some pellets of who knows what. Whatever else. But at the same time, you look at the label and, you know, it does say that there's some, you know, the odd bit of corn, the oats and the beet pulp and stuff like that. Is that enough to get their system going in that?
Yeah. Part? I mean, if there's already oats in the feed and then you just add more oats on the day of the ride, then yes, it should be enough to already have primed the system.
Okay.
Yeah. And, if it's a feed that already has some bee pulp, adding more bee pulp shouldn't be too much of a problem. Yeah.
And, okay.
Now,
Judy?
Yeah,
let me throw the questions to you because you had, I think, the best pre-questions. I want to make sure that we get through those adequately. And
yeah, okay, because I have, like, the ones that you sent, like, what is the recommendation for feed regimen the day prior to, morning of, and immediately following the race?
Right.
Really good question. So the feed regimen the day before should probably involve free choice forage, so the horse can eat as much and stock up as much as possible of forage. And then the grain meals, pretty much normal what you would normally be feeding, except maybe you might add an extra meal in there just to, again, if I can't imagine the glycogen stores would be down because you usually aren't overworking the horse the week before the race, but just maybe stock up a little bit for the horse. The question on the morning of, I for me, if the horse can have the forage in front of him all night long, and everybody much pretty much does, whether to give a grain meal right before they go out, or a couple hours before they go out, or longer than that. We did a study at KER looking at what happens to blood glucose levels when you feed a meal, and if, a grain meal. And when you feed a grain meal, you'll see, and then this is like if you fed the grain meal at an hour zero, you'll see a gradual rise in blood glucose over 2 to 4 hours. It's peaking about 2 hours, and then insulin starts being released, and it starts taking the glucose out of the blood. And so after about 6 hours, it's back down to the normal level where it started before you fed that grain meal. And but that's grain without any kind of forage. Now, if you add forage to that meal, it's going to moderate that peak and the rise in blood glucose. And if you add fat to that grain, that also moderates it again, so you don't get these huge rises in blood glucose. So if you were just feeding a grain meal to the horse and there wasn't any forage involved, you would think that it would not be a good idea to start exercising that horse anywhere after an hour after you've fed, between an hour and 4 hours after you've fed, because that horse would have really high glucose levels and high insulin levels, and that insulin would be pulling the glucose out of the blood. And what we saw at KR is that when the horse was exercised at that time, then you had this drop in glucose that was below the normal level for glucose. So you, like, the horse sort of crashed a little bit in glucose levels, and that's because the insulin was still doing the job. So that would come. There's where the recommendation would come out of not feeding a grain meal anytime, either more than 4 hours before the horse starts exercise, or right immediately before the horse starts exercising. Now, as I said, if you add forage to that picture, it moderates that glucose peak, and if you add fat also, that moderates that glucose peak. So how critical that is with our endurance horses, it's not quite as clear. It would definitely be critical to a horse that, a racehorse, for example, that whose effort is intense and is over in about 2 minutes. But for our endurance horses, it's not quite as straightforward. But I think that, again, starting with a full plate, starting with a hindgut full of forage is really important for the animal. And then exactly when to feed that grain meal in the morning of, if you could do it for 4 hours before the horse starts, that's probably the best. But if it doesn't happen that way, you know, you can feed it within an hour of them starting, and that's fine too. Immediately following the race, there's a window, and this is really also important for multi-day rides. The muscle, when you've depleted glycogen out of the muscle tissue, there's a window where the muscle's glycogen stores can be replenished easier or quicker, and right after exercise, it's like about 2 hours after exercise, and then after that, it's a little bit more effort. So if you can get a grain meal, some starch into the horse after the horse is finished and cooled down and the heart rate's down and all of that, the sooner you can get that grain meal into that horse, the more it'll help with rebuilding those muscle glycogen stores. So that's the recommendation on following the race. Is there any...
When you say the heart rate's down to...
Yeah, down below 60 beats. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So if it's in the 40s, it's okay to go ahead and start feeding then.
Yeah.
it's almost like what you would do in a hold by the time.
But all the way doing during the race, the same sort of thing.
Okay. Because I used to feed, 3 to 4 hours before, and got convinced that, what I was doing then was helping make my horse more hyper at the start of the ride, which particularly with Supro, he didn't need extra help to be hyper.
Yeah.
And so I've gone now to like 6 to 7 hours before.
Uh-huh.
And I guess the one risk of that is, should I also be feeding just before because I'm going to run out of energy, or if he's getting enough forage, then I should be okay, I guess. I can wait and do the first next feed.
Yeah, first stop. Yeah.
First stop.
And in the forage building before, if your horse isn't typically on alfalfa, so it's typically just out in pasture, would you recommend starting that alfalfa several days ahead of the race time, again, to kind of introduce what's happening in the gut?
I would. Yes, and not large amounts. It doesn't have to be huge amounts, but maybe throwing out a half a flake or something
mm-hmm.
a day, just so that they've, that the microbial population in the hindgut, particularly forages, is important, have the opportunity to kind of adjust to having a little bit of that type of forage in the diet. So it does help.
Okay.
Okay.
Can I ask one clarification there, for what we do?
Okay.
Typically, we have been giving a meal about 2 hours before the start of a ride, but and some of it's just out of habit. The horses kind of expect a meal in the morning. But what we do is we've been trying to load. They like beet pulp, so we put a lot of beet pulp in there and then just a half or a third of the amount of grain that they would normally get. So they really are getting a much more beet pulp, which is the high fiber, I guess.
Right.
But they still get a little grain in there. They know it's there, and they work to get it and all that kind of stuff. But it's just not the same quantity they would normally get.
Yeah.
Does that sound like a little better strategy than...
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of your grain and forage.
Yeah, combined.
In 2 hours, would that...
In two hours?
Is that okay?
Then that would be okay, yeah.
Okay. Because I thought it also gives them a little shot of water, too, at the same time.
Yeah, because if you're giving them soaked beet pulp.
Right.
Yep.
Okay.
That's a good plan. Okay. One of the next questions was, do horses' systems benefit from notions typical for human endurance athletes? For example, more protein following a hard endurance effort to assist in rebuilding muscle mass. Yes, they do, because there is a lot of breakdown of muscle tissue during the endurance effort. And so getting them a little extra protein is helpful. Now, if you've already put them on, maybe they're getting a little alfalfa. They've had alfalfa during the ride. They're not normally getting alfalfa, but they get a little alfalfa after the ride. Alfalfa is higher in protein than grass hay. So there's one way to get more protein into it. If you're increasing the amount of grain you're feeding to kind of help them rebuild anyway, then they're getting more protein than they normally would be getting, because even if it's a 12% protein, that's a percentage. So if you're feeding 1 pound of a 12% protein, well, let's make this easier on my my brain for a minute, a 10% protein feed. If you're feeding 1 pound of 10% protein feed, then you're feeding a tenth a pound of protein. If you're feeding 10 pounds of a 10% protein feed, you're feeding a pound of protein. So it's all dependent on the quantity. So if you're increasing the amount of grain, you're giving them more protein anyway. And then there are a few balancer-type products on the market that are higher in protein, usually about 25 to 30% protein. So maybe adding a little bit of that would help also, or maybe a little bit of soybean meal. So it does, but that's only for 24 to 48 hours, probably where it would be helpful. there's any questions on that one.
Well, what percentage?
What is this, a multi-day ride?
The multi-day ride. Yes, it's the same sort of thing. Try to get a little more. You're probably going to be feeding them more anyway because you're trying to build up for the next day's ride also. So they'll be getting more protein that way. But maybe adding a little bit of a balancer would be helpful even in those circumstances. The nice thing about protein is, contrary to popular belief, not hard on the kidneys. It's what the, you know, if you get too much protein in the diet, it's broken down for energy. So, and then the part that's not used for energy is nitrogen that's in the protein. And so that just, the body just, the kidneys filters the nitrogen out in the urine. But since these horses probably do have a higher need for protein, it's you shouldn't fear that you're not going to cause the horse to tie up if it gets a little extra protein. You're not going to cause any damage to the kidney. So it would be a good thing.
Kathleen, this is Allison.
Hi, Allison.
Hi. When you're talking about these balancers, are you talking about an all-things type of product? Is that?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, all right. And then I guess alfalfa, because it's got, my horses eat some alfalfa all the time because I don't want to suddenly appear at a ride with a bunch of alfalfa.
Uh-huh.
And they're not eating a lot. You know, they get, I take a flake and split it between four horses or something in a day.
Okay. So
but then at least when I get to a ride and they really want to eat alfalfa, I don't feel like they're getting something they haven't had.
Uh-huh.
But that's adding protein right there too, presumably, high quality,
uh-huh,
Western alfalfa.
Yeah.
Okay. So it probably wouldn't hurt to give them a little bit more of that too, closer,
right,
to the ride, which probably is what I do anyway without thinking, because I get to ride camp and then they want it. I'm happy they're eating it, mix it in with their hay. They're eating a lot of forage. So, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, the next question that was on the list was supplementing fat. I think it's supposed to be fat for calories, and we've already been through that one, so I'll skip on to the next one. In general, does the higher-end endurance feed make sense? If what is working now seems to be working well, how much of the diet would go that way, and how would the balance versus free choice good quality forage? Well, anyway, but going to the first part of that question, how, in general, does the higher end endurance feed make sense if what's working seems to be working well? If what is working well for you is working, then there's no reason to change and spend more money on a special endurance feed. So if that answers the question that's being asked here. And how would that balance versus free choice good quality forage? The high-end endurance feed is not a does not replace forage. It should also be fed with free choice good quality forage. So it high endurance will also balance out free choice forage. Whatever. Can I ask who asked this question?
That was me.
Okay, because I'm just not sure if it was whatever you're doing right now.
Well, let me just explain a little more. I mean, our horses are out on pasture 24/7,
uh-huh,
and they have, you know, more pasture than they could possibly eat. And I do a mix of sort of an endurance feed and a low-end feed mixed together, and they don't get a lot of that. They seem to be doing fine,
uh-huh,
you know, but am I ever, you know, the quest for the perfect thing, you know, you can, it's like you can just go on this search, this feed search, you know, so that was part of why I asked. If you, you know, if you're doing something that seems to be working, just stay with what you got versus,
yeah,
a smaller amount of feed that was a more concentrated amount. Is it better for the system, for the GI tract, to have smaller amounts of highly concentrated food, or a sort of more whatever it is that's working is working idea. Does that help at all?
Yes. Now, if you yeah, mixing the endurance food with low end feeds, I guess is bringing your cost down.
It's bringing my cost down, and my horses were raised on nothing but oats.
Oh, okay.
When they were, you know, when they lived with their breeder, all they got were plain oats, and they had 1,000 acres of pasture. You know? So they're used to very low-grade feed with my thinking. And then I was trying to get more fat in the system and introduce some beet pulp. So my endurance feed, you know, is a high-fat feed with beet pulp. And my thinking was keep them what they were used to, the lower-end stuff, and then introduce a little bit of the more endurance-type feed.
If that works for you, that's fine. The one question as a nutritionist is more on the balance of the vitamins and the minerals that the horses are getting, and that would depend on the size of the horses and what quantity they're getting and what's in that lower end feed. The endurance feed, of course, is going to have the balance that was supposed to be to complement a forage diet.
Right.
But it probably has like a minimum feeding rate. If you looked on the tag, it probably says feed 4 to 8 pounds or 5 to 10 pounds or something per day. And when you go under that, then you probably are shorting the horse on minerals. Now, your low-end feed probably has vitamins and minerals in it also, so maybe by mixing them, you're not really shorting them. But not knowing the feeds myself, I can't tell you. But then even if you're mixing with the lower-end feed, if you're giving below the minimum feeding rate on either of them, they might be shorted. So the short end of what I'm trying to say is that they may have a balanced diet. They may not. I'm not knowing the feeds. But you can, if you wanted to be sure, you could top it off with a vitamin and mineral mix. Or if your horses are, with the combination, the two are getting the minimum feeding rate, then it probably shouldn't be a problem.
Okay. What vitamins and minerals are missing in forage?
What are missing? I can't say anything that's missing. What is a problem is they are borderline deficient or just low, below the optimal level. So the major one here on the East Coast and Northwest, and it truly is deficient in those forages in those regions of the United States. So selenium is a big mineral. That's a problem. What else is low in forages in general all over the country would be copper, zinc. So when I do a diet evaluation of a horse that's on an all-forage diet, I'll see that they have those nutrients. There is copper, there is zinc, but a lot of times it doesn't quite meet what we would consider optimal levels of that intake for the horse.
Because part of what I always get exercised with on grain rations is our horses seem to maintain weight and energy on, like, for the sake of argument, a pound of grain twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
They're on free choice pasture and hay.
Right.
Then we know that they're not selenium deficient because we get them tested.
Okay.
At the same time, it's like, okay, the nominal ration is 4 pounds twice a day, which is like four times what we normally feed. And I kind of look at them and say, you don't need that amount to keep your weight. Am I shorting them on their minerals?
Yeah, well, the only way to really know would be to have your hay and your pasture analyzed and then And then look at the that combined with your the amount that you're actually feeding of the feed, and you could count, you know, okay, the hay has 0.16 parts per million of selenium, and then the grain ration has at 1 pound or 2 pounds a day, 1 scoop or something, 2 pounds a day, would offer 1 milligram of, or 1 parts per million of selenium, and just so that's the only way to really know for sure if you're shorting them, is actually to do a diet. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But haven't we done yours?
I don't think we've actually done mine. Mine's so much in line with what I would call generic that it's hard to think outside the box in some senses, at least in my own head, other than, you know, there may be a mineral here or there that we're not actually hitting.
Yeah. The other thing that, like, selenium is that if there's adequate vitamin E in the diet, they kind of it compensates a little bit for selenium, and if there's adequate selenium and inadequate vitamin E, then that way it compensates a little bit. And if your horse is getting good grass, then the vitamin E levels are usually quite adequate. In the wintertime when they're on hay only, then it's questionable because vitamin E doesn't stay around in the hay as long as we'd like to see it, or as high levels that we'd like to see. And that's where the additional, you know, grain might have some vitamin E that would help with that. The problem with these mineral deficiencies is if they're there, they're sometimes really subtle, and the horse can go quite a long time before you ever realize you have a problem, or one horse might be affected more severely than another. And it doesn't usually manifest itself as something you might say, oh, that's a mineral deficiency. Maybe they come up with some sort of chronic lameness, but the reason that it actually started was probably because it didn't have enough of maybe some sort of mineral in the diet. But in the end, it shows up as a lameness, but you never associate the one with the other. That's the hard thing about trying to make sure our horses have enough, because if they have enough protein in the diet, they have enough calories in the diet, then they're going to look pretty decent. They're going to have good muscle tissue and hold their weight well. But whether they're suffering from these problems with minerals is way too subtle to just look on the outside. If you go to some other countries and when you really see some gross mineral imbalances, you see it in the coat pretty easily. You get a dull, rough coat, particularly those tropical countries where they have problems with oxalates that tie up calcium. So then it's pretty obvious. But here in this country, it's pretty subtle if there's a problem.
And I know you can get the selenium levels tested for in a blood sample type thing.
Mm-hmm.
When you come to copper and zinc, can you do something similar, or are they just...
Not as easy. Selenium is about the only mineral that is fairly easily tested in the blood. It's not as straightforward with copper and zinc.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, somebody might say that you could do hair analyses, but we're not focusing on whether those are... they're great for detecting... heavy metal poisonings and things like that, that's for sure. But as for subtle deficiencies in copper and zinc, it's still not as clear.
Are there multivitamins for horses?
There are. There
are, they worth it?
Are they worth it?
Given what we just talked about?
Yeah. If you're just not quite sure, just a general multivitamin, because they're usually made supplied with the same sort of minerals, vitamins and minerals that are put into the feeds anyway. So, and we've done, there's been enough work on the absorption of the mineral sources that you find in common feeds in horses to know that they are absorbed, not 100%, but we actually know the percentage of zinc sulfate that is absorbed by the digestive tract and things like that. So, it's a reassurance for the minerals that the regular vitamin minerals are another way to just kind of make sure that the horse is getting enough, that they're getting well below the recommended feeding rate on a feed. But when it comes to something like vitamin E, what we have found is that the natural vitamin E's are much better absorbed and utilized by the horse. So,
okay.
Yeah, so that it may be worth investing in a separate, if you can't find a vitamin mineral supplement that has a vitamin E, the natural vitamin E in it, then just getting a separate natural vitamin E for the horse.
But you say grass has, assuming that you're in a grass area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when it's green, there should be good vitamin E, and there should be good vitamin A or in the form of carotene.
Okay. Then the other question was the use of alfalfa, and I know.
Yeah.
For
what about
a while,
alfalfa
was the bad guy on the block type of a thing almost.
Yeah, it was. It used to be. What about linked to stumps and versus tying up? Okay. I think that mixing a little alfalfa in the diet, on a regular diet, is not a problem at all. There's been some recent studies on the effect of alfalfa in the diet on ulcer development, and they saw that having alfalfa in the diet versus a straight grass hay, they found that the horses if they had ulcers, then it decreased the severity of the ulcers. And then the other thing if they were in a way, under the stresses to develop ulcers, they didn't develop as badly when they had some alfalfa in the diet as they do when in straight grass hay. So right there, since we are stressing our horses by trailering and taking them in new situations, there might be reason enough to want to have some alfalfa, not only that it tastes good to them, but also to have it in the diet. So a little bit in the diet, I think, is not a problem. Where they saw alfalfa as having a link to stump is when it was a pure alfalfa diet. And what happens is the high calcium in the diet makes the system a little bit lazy for mobilizing calcium, so that when they're working hard and they need to mobilize calcium, it just doesn't function as well, and so that's when they might start to thump. So, but that those are, like I say, when the diet is almost strictly alfalfa. There are horses, particularly in the West Coast, that live on pure alfalfa diets and are fine. I don't know how many of those are endurance horses that live on pure alfalfa that do fine. There's a lot of backyard horses that do have an alfalfa-only diet. But for the endurance horse, I think a mix is definitely the way to go and not pure alfalfa.
I have I wrote this one and I didn't do my research properly. You're right, it's ulcers not tying up, that basically was indicating that alfalfa might be good.
Yep.
In a very positive sense. Although I have to say that I had a horse that thumped, and I think this is what you might call the individual case basis type thing.
Uh-huh.
He had a phrenic nerve that probably went pretty darn close to the heart under ordinary circumstances.
Uh-huh.
And so he just tended to be more prone to thumping as a matter of course.
Yes, and it wasn't related to diet, probably.
And at the same time, when we lived in California and we fed him more alfalfa, you know, it wasn't pure alfalfa diet by any stretch of the imagination, but he had alfalfa consistently in his diet in, you know, like maybe 50% of the hay he got was alfalfa. He would thump regularly.
Regularly. Yeah.
And we finally wound up managing his electrolytes a whole lot more carefully. And we went away from alfalfa under any circumstances, basically, except for...
And that took care of the problem?
In the races. And that pretty much took care of the problem.
Yeah. That's definitely a wide range of what they can of individuality in what they tolerate.
Right. And as I say, it's one of these individual case basis types of things. He's the only horse we've had out of maybe 10 that we've done serious endurance racing with that had that particular problem. But then again, we changed all of our attitudes as a result of it.
Yeah. Funny how one horse can do that to you.
Yeah. Are there other questions from other people on the line here?
I have one. and that is... how, particularly given what you said about, you know, they use fat and all, you know, I've always had a bias towards having horses carry a little bit more weight into particularly hundreds, not necessarily 50s, but hundreds, and the feeling that they needed that to help them get through the ride. On the other hand, I know that a lot of the people in the Mideast now almost like their horses greyhound-like. And so I wanted to get your views on, you know, what is the right weight, and also is it, again, it goes back to the type of ride you're doing and how much difference does that make? You know, if you're doing a Old Dominion or a Tevis or Vermont, is it more important to have the horse in good weight as opposed to if you're going to do a, you know, 7 or 100 at a gallop, then, and they've got, you know, 5 stops in between, then that becomes less important. So that's not a very well articulated question, but it's, you know,
no, I understand
what your views on.
You're asking. Yes, I think here in the U.S., the rides we have, and that the horse is more important for the horses to have good body weight, and I think that a study that was done at the Tevis brings it really home on how important it is. And that was that 2 years in a row they took, they did body weights and body condition scores on the horses. And the body condition score runs from 1 to 9, and 5 being average, and that 5 is what you would, if you look at a horse and you can't see the ribs, but you can feel them very easily. And then there's a couple other places that they look at the fat cover, but that's just to give you a kind of a general idea of where the 5 would be, and that a horse, that the 4, you can, you're starting to see the ribs when he's walking down, you know, walking away from you. So what they did is they found that the horses that had a body score of 3.5 and under, not a single horse in the Tevis finished. And that, so obviously it's important, particularly for these tougher rides where they do have climbs and they are going longer during the day. They're going slower and longer. It is important to have that extra body condition. The other thing that in the Middle East, so these they have the really fast rides. But Tom Ivers was hired by one of the not Muhammad Sheikh Mohammed, but one of the other shakes to Tom Ivers. It was a big time racehorse person who had some really kind of novel ideas on how to make racehorses perform better. And he went into a barn, and this was maybe, I don't know, 15 years ago. He went into the barn and made all these changes and told him that the horses were too fat, carrying too much weight, and got these horses down to in body condition scores threes and a half. And the horses stopped finishing races, and so they fired Tom. But so there they are, even at the higher speeds, you could see that it still would be important to have some extra reserve, body fat reserve.
Okay.
The other extreme, of course, you don't want them too fat, because then they just get full as well as they need to.
We have one of those.
Yeah.
He doesn't get any grain to speak of at all. You know, you kind of look at it, and he puts on weight just by looking at grass.
Well, we have one of those.
But he doesn't compete either, so.
That would be the reason for not caring too much. But definitely they have to have enough to be able to draw upon to be able to do the work that they're doing going down the trail. Does that answer your question, Greg?
Yeah, that's helpful. It sort of reaffirms, particularly given the type of races that we like to do, which are the, you know, Old Dominions and Vermonts and all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
the tougher, longer.
That it is better to have the horses are carrying more weight.
Sue, any other questions?
Nope, it's been very helpful for me.
Okay.
Yeah, me too.
Good. Well, listen.
I particularly like your article. Thank you very much for sharing that with us.
You're welcome. I just thought it might be informative for people because there have been so many questions about that recently.
Yeah,
that was great. Have you read Cheryl's going to hit me, but she can't do that because I'm in Charlotte and she's in Asheville. Have you read a book called Horses of the Sahara, Kathleen?
No, I haven't.
Oh. It has things about feed and water that totally blow my mind. And I can send it to you. It's electronic. It was written in 1850 by a French general.
Oh, I would say.
Copyright has expired.
Yeah, copyright's expired. And he was trying to capture... He became convinced that the horses of the Sahara, Algeria and that parts, were the best war horses in the world, and the Arabian tribesmen of the desert were the best equestrians in the world, which was pretty radical thinking for a European cavalry officer.
Yeah.
And he became buddies with the emir and tried to capture all their secrets. Now, of course, the problem you have is, one, were they telling him accurate information? Was he translating it right, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah.
But I'll send it to you because it is fascinating. There's a lot of things that are in there that, you know, I think are really valid lessons for us. And then I think there are other things that possibly don't apply. And, of course, they had been selectively breeding, you know, horses for, you know, many centuries of a particular type, which may not apply to our type, but it's a fascinating read, and I'll send it to you, and then we can talk about it at Old Dominion or something.
Yeah, that'd be great. You know, because if you've seen the movie Hidalgo,
yeah,
in the movie, the horse never sees a blade of grass. The only thing he's living off of dates and camel's milk, and you just wonder how in the world he did it. So there has to be some forage somewhere in the horses' diet for these horses in the Sahara, but I did wonder about it.
Yeah, well, they were very big on barley and other grains, some of which, you know, didn't mean anything to me. They may be things peculiar to the desert, but I'll send it to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Then we can use it for the next call.
One of the things that is fascinating that I'll share with people on the call, do you know how old the horses were when they started conditioning them? Up to pretty good distances, up to 15 or 20 miles.
Was it younger than, what, like 5 years? Or
It was typically 18 to 36 months.
Wow.
Wow.
But here's the kicker. It was with 5-year-olds.
Kids.
You know, then with the kids. And then of course, we get rested for a while. Yeah, and then the adults would, start riding them. They wouldn't use them as war horses till they were 8.
Oh, okay.
But they would, when they were young, get, work pretty substantively, but it was with essentially no weight on the back. And I'm sure the kids were more expendable than the horses to the culture. So,
bad dog. But
anyway, it's a fun
bag.
Okay, I'll send that to you. Now, Cheryl knows I keep talking about this book. And
is it Dumas? Is that what it is?
That's the one.
Yes, but yeah, you can find it online if you do.
I just downloaded it.
Yeah, okay, good.
I Googled it, and you can get it as a PDF.
Yeah.
Yep, that's it. It's a fascinating read. I'd recommend it to everybody.
This is Alice. I have to tell you that when we found Kazar, he was 8 years old, and the only people that had ever been on his back were small children.
Okay, so
not untrained.
There you go.
Kids would get on him in the round pen and ride until they fell off. And that was it. And it was 8. So there you go. Maybe there was something to that.
Yep.
Good. Well, be. Okay. Good. It's been great to meet you, Kathleen.
Anyway, good luck, kids. So funny. Yeah. Anyway,
okay.
Are you in Charlotte for a few days?
Are
you there?
Just till tomorrow. Just till tomorrow. I've got to.
Okay. I was going to say, I'd meet you for lunch or something if you were stuck in town for a few days.
Oh, thank you. No, I've got a early morning meeting, and then I head back.
Yeah, you
to Modern World.
Get around 10 a.m. and load them up with a bunch of alfalfa.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, did you drive your truck? No, I'm just kidding. Well,
okay.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. I'm going to get off the phone.
This has been very good, as always. Thank you very much, Kathleen. Much
you're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. Bye.
Have a good evening. Bye.